Bookstack with Richard Aldous, the Books and Ideas podcast brought to you by AmericanPurpose.com. Coming up on the show today, Leah Hunt Hendricks, author of the new book written with Astra Taylor, Solidarity, the Past, Present and Future of a World-Changing Idea. Leah, welcome to Bookstack.
Thank you so much for having me.
Congratulations on the new book. At one point, you say that solidarity is an untidy concept. So what exactly is it?
Well, we say it's untidy because it covers so many things. There are so many kinds of solidarity. And part of the purpose of the book is to help people think through the concept. So we think of solidarity, you know, Emile Durkheim, the French sociologist from the late 1800s, was the first person to really theorize about solidarity. And for him, it's a concept of social cohesion. But you also, at around the same time in the height of the Industrial Revolution, the rising labor movement, it becomes a concept of social transformation. So right there at the birth of the idea, it's almost two totally different things. But Astra and I think that that actually makes sense because social cohesion does involve change and transformation. And solidarity really is about holding people together across differences. It's not unity. It's not sameness. It's not oneness. It's about building new collective identities that can hold people together across their differences.
And you point out right at the very beginning that so much in contemporary politics is actually about divide and conquer. You give the example of Nixon's Southern strategy. And obviously, that's a principle that all sides in politics seem to have weaponized. So really what you're trying to do here is the opposite of that.
Yeah. Well, solidarity has been a really powerful force for change. When you think about it as the force that has brought together mass movements like abolition, women's suffrage, more recently the climate movement, the movement for reproductive health or for racial justice, and those movements are threats to the status quo. Just by definition, they're trying to change, you know, the current way of doing things. So that's threatening to people who are benefiting from the status quo. So the response is these divide and conquer tactics that try to break solidarity and kind of push back on these movements. We've seen that recently in, you know, the rise of this critique of wokeism. You know, in the past decade, we're trying to learn to be anti-racist, and that is not a bad thing. That's a really good thing. And we've seen, you know, the criminalization of doctors who are trying to help women get abortions, the criminalization of aiding migrants who are trying to find safe harbor, safe places to live, fleeing from violent conflicts, the criminalization of aiding protesters. For example, in Cop City protests in Atlanta, there's been a real criminalization of trying to help bail protesters out of jail. That's now illegal to help more than three people. So these are ways of tamping down on social movements and kind of trying to break solidarity. We really need to recognize that we're in this moment of backlash, but that's a tactic, and it's something to resist if you want progressive change.
So all of the examples that you gave there are broadly speaking on the political left of the spectrum. So is solidarity something which is across the political spectrum, or is it something which is to the left on the political spectrum as you see it?
I think that solidarity is, you know, by definition, it's kind of a neutral concept, this sense of group cohesion, but this can go in different directions. So Astra and I try to distinguish between what we call reactionary solidarity versus transformative solidarity as a way of helping people parse through what are some of the differences. And I wouldn't say it's just transformative is left and reactionary is right, but I think these are actually structurally different. Both are forms of holding people together, but reactionary solidarity creates a strong in-group that really seeks to kind of extinguish the out-group. Or to dominate or to annihilate the outgroup. transformative solidarity asks the question of like, what is the greater good? How can we kind of transform and create systems that are better for everyone? And so it seeks to overcome things like patriarchy or white supremacy, because those are systems that are not actually good for men or for white people. You know, men suffer from aspects of patriarchy that force them into certain boxes. And Heather McGee has a great book, The Sum of Us, that writes about how we all suffer from white supremacy and racism because of the ways in which it kind of undermines our investments in public goods. So transformative solidarity, it doesn't try to annihilate its opponents. It tries to create a world where it does take them on kind of positionally. You know, I'm thinking of people like Elon Musk or Rupert Murdoch, or the phrase like, we want a world without billionaires. It's not that we want those. We want a world where no one has enough power and a position where they are able to kind of single-handedly determine life for many other communities and people.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that Marx is probably the most famous writer on solidarity, but yeah, I'm kind of interested that you argue that economic class is not enough to understand the term, that it goes beyond that.
Yeah, Marx and Marxists didn't really do enough to theorize solidarity, because they thought that just the basic class position would be enough to make it self-evident that why working class people should unite and work and fight together. But that's not the case. And we've seen, you know, a lot of ways that race and gender and other kind of aspects of people's identities factor into how people think about what groups they really belong with. And so economic justice is one of my main like motivations and interests. And I do think that that's like fundamental to the work of a progressive project, but it's not enough to build solidarity, because there are these other identities that come into play.
And certainly the class aspect is fascinating here. I mean, obviously solidarity was a rallying cry for the working class and trades unions in the 19th century. But what about the working class today? It's very striking that Donald Trump, for example, has been able to draw a lot of his support from working class voters, and many seem to be finding solidarity in the Republican Party. So how do you square that circle?
There are a couple of things. On the one hand, there's been a real attack on the labor movement over the past 40, 50 years. Well, actually, since Taft-Hartley, the American labor policy has long been really antagonistic towards working class people coming together. You know, it's unique in America that the solidarity strike is illegal. An interesting story right now is in, I think it's Sweden, Swedish Tesla workers have been trying to unionize and create a contract with Tesla. And Danish workers have joined, postal workers stopped delivering Tesla license plates. The trash workers stopped picking up the trash at the Tesla factory. A Danish pension fund divested. So those are all like solidarity action, solidarity strikes that in the United States would be illegal because of the Taft-Hartley Act. And indeed, Elon Musk is suing, and so we'll see what happens. But, you know, policy creates the structures, law and policy creates the structures through which people can or can't organize. And so that's been a fundamental form of demobilizing working class solidarity in the United States. And then the attacks, further attacks in the 1970s and 80s on unions through right to work laws. So you have that context, the diminishing of the power of unions over decades. And then you have Donald Trump kind of coming in with pretty outright racist language, sort of inviting people into a new community around white masculinity for the most part.
But presumably you're not implying that working class voters who vote for Donald Trump are all racist.
I think that there is a draw, that is a big part of his narrative and messaging.
So this would be similar to Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables, that kind of analysis.
No, I think that people are struggling and people are looking for community and belonging and finding and to find something to be a part of that will change the way that they are feeling, like their current conditions, their feelings of isolation. And Trump offers that for a lot of people. But it's certainly not through policies that would actually benefit working class people. He's created the biggest tax breaks for the wealthy. So I do not think that Trump's followers, you know, are kind of the opponents of progressive solidarity. I do think though that people like Trump can mobilize people through fear-based language, saying, and the idea of status threat, you know, that like you have a lot to lose by other people who are trying to gain more rights in society. And that makes sense psychologically, but I think it has really negative consequences for everyone.
In the book, you propose moving away from the welfare and social security state to something you describe as the solidarity state. What does that mean in practice?
Yeah, well, this partly goes back, I'll take us all the way back to the 1800s when the concept of solidarity was first being sort of thought about primarily in France. It's a really fascinating moment in history. And there's actually a small movement called the Solidarists who are thinking, perhaps solidarity is a way between kind of the pull of collectivism or in like state control versus individualism and free market capitalism. And they propose the idea that the state's function should be to build social solidarity. And it should help us see ourselves as citizens and as part of a collective project. And part of that has economic consequences. It does involve ensuring that no one has too much power in society. So preventing monopolies, having progressive taxation, having a strong safety net. The Solidarists were part of building the welfare state, but they also thought there should be public support for worker cooperatives and other forms of local democracy structures where people had decision-making power locally. And we wanted to bring this idea back up because in American politics, it feels sometimes like we're still stuck between sort of a binary of kind of the liberal state, a minimalist state where the free market plays a larger role, or a more welfare state model, maybe the Bernie Sanders model of a stronger state and much more kind of public ownership and stronger safety net policies. Economic redistribution, again, I think is fundamental, but we sort of say that to even get the welfare state, maybe we need to go beyond it and to think about a vision of the state as doing more than just economic redistribution, but actually building social solidarity. Because when people don't see themselves as part of a shared society, they don't have as much motivation to support building public goods. Again, Heather McGee's great book, The Sum of Us, talks a lot about the public pool getting undermined, basically because of racism, you know, white people not wanting to swim with black people. And so we've seen a lot of public pools disappear over decades. And so are there policies that help help bring people together? For example, in Canada, there's actually a fund to build multiculturalism. It's a public fund that supports programs and events and organizations that are helping people recognize like the pluralism that makes up Canadian society. So that's one example. But are there other things? You know, I think about there is a vast interest in programs like Peace Corps and AmeriCorps and kind of service programs. Far more interest than there are actual slots for those jobs. And what if we had that really expanded? What if everyone did, you know, 2 years of service in an American community before college or around that time? Like, wouldn't that that help people, you know, begin to see themselves as part of the same society, kind of like the public works programs also after the Great Depression, that we're like building something together. So we don't claim to like have the whole plan of what a solidarity state would look like, but we wanted to offer it as a provocation for policymakers and movement leaders and others to think about what if we did have that lens as we created policy and created our visions of how we want to organize ourselves.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you talk about the binary element of politics there. But on the other hand, you are also very critical of centrists in the book, who you see essentially as being part of the problem, not the solution.
Well, I first of all kind of like to push back on the idea of left, right, center, even as a frame, because it makes it seem like the center is the place that makes the most sense. It's the moderate between the extremes. And I don't actually think that's the case. I think that people are much more all over, just all over the map in how they identify and the positions they take. But people who do often see themselves as moderates, I think often fall too much into the trap of accepting the divide and conquer tactics that are being used by those in power, and, you know, resist the attempts of these social movements to create change by saying like they're too extreme, but you know, these movements, it's not extreme to say, can we live in a society where people from all backgrounds are accepted and treated equally, or where everyone has enough, where no one's sleeping on the streets? Like, to me, that's what civilization should aspire to. It's not an extremist perspective. So yeah, we do kind of push back on the idea that there's this idea of like a moderate position that is between the left and right that has a more plausible path forward.
And in terms of moving forward, I mean, you've talked about elites, you've talked about the powerful. Where does the balance lie? I mean, for example, is it someone like Richard Rorty who says that, you know, you need change to come from above and below, that yes, you need kind of people, activists on the ground, grassroots movements, but you also need those at the top to use his phrase, lend a hand. But for real change to come, you have to have both.
I do believe that people from all positions in society can play a role in creating constructive change. My own focus has been on the philanthropic sector.
Although you are also quite critical of philanthropy in the book as well, which is surprising because, as you say, you've been very involved in it yourself.
Yeah, and I think even well-meaning elites and philanthropists can do harm, even if they think that they're on the right side. And this is why the idea of solidarity is so important. If they don't actually see themselves in solidarity, which means benefiting from the changes that the movements that they're supporting are aspiring to create, if they don't see themselves as actually beneficiaries, not just benefactors, see themselves as recipients of the better world that's trying to be created, not just the elite creator of that world, if they see themselves as the actor, the agent, the protagonist, as opposed to someone who's in partnership with other active agents and protagonists, you know, too often it's the donor is kind of imposing their will on the grantee, or, you know, there's a condescension, paternalism. There's a lot of ways that, you know, attempts at benevolence can go wrong. And so we call those semblances of solidarity. Things like the ideas of benevolence, altruism, charity, they're all aspiring in the right direction. But Philip Pettit writes a book on the idea of republicanism, which is trying to aspire to non-domination. And he defines domination as being able to arbitrarily impose your will on others without their consent. And philanthropy can do that. And there are ways that elites do that, and even when they're trying to create positive outcomes. So we just want to invite, elites and the world of philanthropy, because it's necessary, it exists, it plays a role. So we want to invite all of those communities into the possibility of social change, but also to invite people into some self-awareness, self-criticism, and to use the idea of solidarity as a tool to kind of examine what is your motivation. Is it pity or is it solidarity?
And so presumably that's what you try to do when you're involved in your own philanthropic endeavors.
I grew up in a family with a family foundation, and actually the money came from an oil company. And so I have tried to, in part, participate in supporting the climate movement, and, you know, to kind of make up for some of the ways in which the wealth that I've gained some access to has come from really, you know, from industries that will have negative consequences for a lot of communities suffering from climate change. And also to try to support the revival of the labor movement in the United States and the power of working class communities, as well as trying to tamp down the power of corporations by reviving antitrust laws and increasing progressive taxation. So I think that what I call philanthropy and solidarity would do is to try to put itself out of business, to try to create a world where, you know, everyone can give, everyone can support their local communities and local initiatives, but where no philanthropist has the power to single-handedly kind of determine what organizations should or shouldn't be attempting to do. You know, like, for example, Bill Gates, like, owns the World Health Organization because he's the biggest donor to it. And that has some negative consequences. It resulted partly in the privatization of the COVID vaccine. So we don't want a world where a few elites have overwhelming power. So philanthropy can play a role in that.
Yeah, you mentioned COVID there. When I was reading the book, I suppose inevitably started reflecting on our recent experiences that, you know, we've all shared. That, I mean, do you think the COVID pandemic did show a kind of solidarity in action, if you like? After all, the lockdown, for example, did by and large work, and that was something that was cooperative. It was something people acting in solidarity with their neighbors.
Great point. There was some level of solidarity during COVID. There often is solidarity created during natural disasters or moments of crisis. I think that COVID was surprising in how little solidarity it created, though, and how much backlash, how much kind of counter solidarity, resistance to masks, resistance to vaccines. Eric Kleinenberg is writing a book on 2020 and has said, you know, we called for social distancing. What we should have called for was physical distancing, but social solidarity, because there was the consequence of that distancing was hard. It isolated people, and perhaps there was more that could have been done to support people maintaining their bonds. You know, thank goodness for Zoom.
Particularly for those who live alone. I mean, crippling for many.
Yeah. So, you know, imagine if there had been a program, a public program during COVID that had made that its focus. So I think COVID was striking. And I think what that tells us is that solidarity isn't a natural phenomenon. It doesn't just happen. It is something that really has to be constructed intentionally. And we have to be prepared and build institutions that aim to create it. And so that's, again, part of the purpose of the book is to say, like, let's make this a priority, just as much as justice or equality or liberty are priorities of democracy. So should solidarity be.
Finally, Leah, you quote the poet and civil rights activist Audre Lorde that solidarity matters because we need each other to succeed. It requires patience, you say, as well as humility and the avoidance of self-righteousness. So I guess my final question is, how hopeful are you that solidarity is something that can be achieved?
I am very hopeful, and I think this book aims to be really constructive and hopeful as well, because, you know, solidarity wouldn't be the powerful force it is if it weren't something thing we all craved and wanted. And I think if we can identify the forms of divide and conquer tactics that are around us and try to resist those, and we can intentionally lean into building community, you know, there's a lot of potential there. And in our last chapter, we talk about some of the virtues of solidarity. We draw on Aristotle, who had talked about the virtues of that citizens need to live in a just society. And friendship was one of the key virtues for him, and as well as others like justice and magnanimity. And so we talk about some of those and include humility and courage. And, you know, so solidarity, it's not just something that we do at the organizational level or the state level. It's also something we can practice in our individual lives. And so just starting there is, I think, something that we can all do. Just how can we be in solidarity better with our neighbors, and take it from there?
So the book is Solidarity, the Past, Present, and Future of a World-Changing Idea. It's written by my guest, Leah Hunt Hendricks, with Astra Taylor, and published by Pantheon Books. But for now, Leah, congratulations again, and thanks for joining us on Bookstack.
Thank you for having us.
So that's it from us this week. Don't forget to check our website, americanpurpose.com, and to leave us a review on your podcast app. The show is produced by Laura Silverman, and this is me, Richard Aldous, saying thanks for listening.